tell me about the farm and your family that's involved in it.
Well, I'll start with the family first. My wife, Mary Ann, she's actually from just across the river in on the Ohio side of Maysville and from the Ripley direction. And we've been married 26 years this year. You know, you kind of, that's just kind of the beginning when life really begins, when you meet somebody and get married, you know. And so 26 years we're married. We have four children. Anna is our oldest. She's in pharmacy school at UK. Samuel's our oldest son. He's 21 now. Anna was 23. Samuel's 21. And he helps us full-time on the farm now. And then Maggie, our younger daughter of the two, she's in her second year at East Kentucky University at Eastern in finance classes, you know. And Asa, our youngest son, is 17 now, and he is a junior at St. Patrick's. So just another this year plus one more year of high school for Asa. And he's kind of our baby, but he's 17 years old now. So we're very proud and very fortunate with our family.
So you are at the dumbest stage of life. According to your kids, you don't know anything. You will eventually become a genius, but for right now, you're at the low end of the intelligence totem pole.
And I'm trying to convince them that with age comes wisdom, but I'm losing the battle because, we've kind of gone through the teenage years. We kind of joke all the time about when they're little and young, you can carry them around. They think you walk on water. Then they get a little older and hit that teenage streak, and it's still fun, but it's a little bit different. It's a little more challenging.
Yeah.
We've enjoyed them a ton, and they've all grew up on the farm. The boys, that's about the first thing they heard their whole childhood. The very first thing they heard was dad yelling, "Boys, let's go." That's because they get up, roll out of bed, go help me, no matter what we did. And just grew up in that type of a, on the farm, just learning to help and be part of what's going on every day. And the girls came and went as we needed them to and where we needed them to. And if we left the house and forgot something, they were the first ones running it to us. Or we needed extra help gathering cows, from riding the Honda to driving the pickup to one of them, especially the older one. Anna loved to ride horses. She'd ride a horse, help gather cattle some. Especially if we had her home, could be in from school or college. And then, as a farmer, family farm, we're focused on the cattle business. That's kind of been my obsession and my interest from just childhood, to be honest. And that's early on starting farming, I guess the best way to say it, I just didn't have a whole lot to start with. Had to start really slow. Did a lot of that tobacco back in the days, a lot of tobacco in our part of the state before it disappeared. But that was that cash crop that everybody grew. It was fairly easy as a young man. I understood I was the labor in a rental type agreement, somebody else owned the land, owned the quota, but I was young and energetic and wanted to make some money and do something, or at least try to. And so I was the labor side of that, tenant farming type equation, but it was good. I never really had the complete interest in tobacco to really want to do it, I guess for my livelihood forever, but at the time it served a purpose well. It actually helped me make a lot of contacts, meet a lot of people, and eventually led to being able to lease some of that ground for more than just growing a tobacco crop, so to speak. And that's where it really started for me, was kind of as a tenant farmer doing things on shares and understanding at the time, that point in life, I was the laborer. I was the guy that was going to get the work done. And as long as I worked well with people, it would come back to me eventually. And it really, really did, because after I got started leasing some ground, once you leased one farm and got along well with the landowner, somebody else would reach out to you or talk to you about it, and just kind of got a chance to grow it pretty quickly on leasing some ground. And eventually the same thing happened on owning some land. It was a older gentleman that owned quite a bit of land, was ready to sell part of it. And I probably wasn't ready to march into a bank and say, "I want to buy a farm." But he came to me and told me, he said, "I want to sell it to you. I want to work with you on it. And we'll work out a deal between us." And really, really was a great opportunity for me to get started kind of in owning some land besides what I leased. And that's really the first time I was able to buy cows and turn out cows. But over the years, just to kind of skip that along, that's what I focused on was, early on was kind of cows and calves. It was the easiest thing for me to get started with. It's what I knew more about. It's what I understood more. But I was always fascinated with the business side of the cattle farming, or the cattle business, and wanted to know more about it than just beyond the traditional Kentucky cow-calf operation. So I pretty quickly began to buy feeder cattle or stockers, you know, other people's calves as they sold them. Always just looking for what I saw as a opportunity or a bargain, something I could upgrade and bring value to. And as I could afford to do it more, that even began just to put more and more of them together, you know, to have those bigger packages of calves to sell. You really build a reputation in the cattle business pretty quickly when you're delivering calves or selling them, and buyers have bought your calves before and know they did well, knew they were what you said they were as far as health and the expectations they would have for the calves. It can help you or hurt you as long as you're being honest and being straight with people, being that guy that don't tell a lie. People learn that about you and they trust you pretty far. And at the same time, if you say things that aren't true, it comes back to you pretty quickly too. So it's a very much a reputation business. So eventually I kind of gravitated more into stockers, and for a number of years did not own any cows, just ran a complete stocker calf operation. I bought other people's calves. And then the next thing in this business of wanting to learn, wanting to understand, was the next step for me, besides just backgrounding calves and selling them here in kind of the local markets, the local sale barns, I took that step and started contacting some of those Western feedlots, those Kansas, Iowa feedlots, you know, these calves went to, you know, and just decided, you know, other people have done it. They figured it out. You know, if I want to do something, I can figure it out too. And kind of got started into that too, to where for pretty much a solid 20-year stretch there, I owned very few cows and calves, but I backgrounded and kept up. I bought a lot of high-risk calves, those balling, I'd call them sort of mismatched calves that had a lot of room to upgrade them, to add a lot of value to them, and learned that even as I grouped up those off-collared calves, those little bit out of the lesser desirable kind of calves, but knew they were good cattle with potential, and I could move them into, say, a Kansas feed yard and put them in an organized lot or group, you know, to be fed out as finished cattle, they still had a lot of appeal, you know. So I bought a lot of scraps, the stuff that other buyers weren't necessarily pursuing hard to buy their uniform, neat set of cattle, you know. So I bought on the fringes a lot and did very well with that. And like I said, did after about 20 years, kept cattle almost continuously on feed in Kansas and some into Iowa. It's the only two states I really ever shipped to. And learned a lot about the cattle business in that stretch. Just you learn and you build as you go. And I saw the value that was in cattle beyond just the local sale barn, or certainly what just was born and raised in my home pastures, you know, because at that point you're marketing those cattle to the packers, so to speak, from the major packers to sold quite a few cattle over years to some of the more regional packers, and you start to market those better cattle onto those grids, those value added type sales, where you do get all that carcass data and information back, and you see the performance on every set of cattle you ship out there. So over time, I would always say I learned a lot from it. It even a little bit changed my perspective on value and what's desirable, especially from a commercial cattle producer's viewpoint. I always feel like it was a very long growing process and learning process that because everything you saw was, you know, just, am I trying to say just so, just the facts, you know. There was no, I think this is a better set of cattle, this is a better idea. Every time those cattle were fed in the feedlot pen, everything that ever went into them, everything's recorded perfectly for you by those commercial feed yards. So you get all that data back, you get a look at it, the performance of the cattle, clear up to when you sell those cattle. And by the end of my experience, you know, feeding cattle, pretty much everything I sold went into a value marketed type of sale. I sold them on the grid with carcass information, got it all back. I knew individually what the calves gained, how they graded, how the packing company paid me for individual calves. And it really began to actually inspired me to feed a little bit better cattle all the time. Especially as I went to more of a value-based sale, I could really, really see the difference. And it's something you almost have to learn for yourself, because everybody's kind of got their own idea of what's the best kind of calf. But when you see it in ink in front of you and you're looking at it and checking off the really well-doing calves versus the not, it really gives you a lot of perspective to take back to the farm, you know. So
I think that's something where farming has gone today and years gone by would have gone by eyesight. Mm-hmm. And now we're going to data.
Yes, sir.
You know, whether
yes,
it's the crop farmer or whether it's the livestock producer, we're measuring, you know, daily weighted gain. We're measuring, we're measuring nearly everything to analyze and see, do our theories match what the performance factor is.
And I would agree with that too. And to have that hard data, so to speak, in front of you. And I can only, you know, just truly, clearly speak to the cattle side of it, but it was just, I always called it that kind of trifecta, for just maybe no better way to say it, but what really paid me well on a calf, and it didn't have to just be hide collar or any other, notion we might think it adds the most value to, but when you sell the carcass and it's graded strictly on carcass merit, you know, you want that good quality grade, you want that high choice, that, top end prime type calf, as much as possible, and a lot of those grid marketings even split a low choice and a high choice. So you start to think, well, and even, you know, learning over time, that's the quality of the cattle. There's a lot of good cattle in Kentucky because I've killed a lot of them in those packing plants, but they grade out very well. But even the feeding period has a real impact on that grading in the end. And that's, to me, is like, how well does that feed yard do managing your cattle and feeding your cattle? How does the weather treat you in that feeding period has a big impact on it. And so there's many things that go into it, but you want that really high quality grade. You want that carcass that when you come back to the yield grade on it, you want all the fat in the in the muscle, you know, not on the outside of the carcass. You start to see those calves that overfatten and overfeed get fat on the outside, then you'll get docked for that. So there's a happy point in there, you know, you want to get to. And then the other thing sometimes I even think a lot of us cattle people forget when you start doing the math on them, quality grading, yield grading, and what does that carcass weigh? Mm-hmm. You know, a quality 950-pound carcass way out values a 650-pound carcass in the same set of cattle. You know, if they don't all perform or have the same growth genetics in them, to get them to that point, because weight matters too, you know. Mm-hmm. Those calves can stand in the same pen, say there's 70 or 80 steers in a pen of cattle being fed, and you see each individual carcass weighed, and if they all come in at the right, you know, the weights they like to have them at, it's still a lot of times it's a 600 to 1,000 pound range, at least, you know, as I was finishing a lot of them cattle, but one that hangs towards that 1,000 pound mark, you know. And back in the day, I kind of stopped feeding a few years ago, but they would actually mark you down if the calf's carcass got too big. And since we've kind of got short on beef, they've taken a lot of that away. You know, they want them cattle fed bigger now, keep the beef tonnage up. But so there was a range to keep those carcass size of those cattle into. But certainly, you know, when you're seeing the difference in value, weight had a big part to do with that. So you wanted them big, heavy, soggy type calves that just grew and grew and grew and never quit, you know, so to speak. So at the same time, we're bred right to kind of hit all the other bells and whistles, that yield grade and quality grade. So that was a important thing to strive for too. So
when I think about your business, did you grow up on a farm? Is part of this something? Are you a continuing generation of a farm, or Did you pull yourself up by the bootstraps and start this thing?
I'm kind of one of those, where did you come from kind of stories. My parents, I did grow up on a farm, mostly grew tobacco. You know, my dad and mom, 80 to 100 cows is about the most they'd ever have. But, you know, and they started, my dad came back from the Vietnam War. He served in Vietnam, came back. His father had kind of run a little, like a, basically a general store type business and had a little bit of land. My mother's father had a little bit of land and logged quite a bit in eastern Kentucky. But long story short, my parents started out, you know, came from a good family, good parents, kind of suffered through the high interest that came after the 70s. It kind of their start, you know, had debt, that interest was just terrible, to them. As the 80s kind of came along, and, you know, I always say there was kind of that farm crisis of the 80s. Mm-hmm. They survived kind of through that period, but struggled terribly. There was four of us children in my family. I was the oldest son, and it was, you know, good parents, you know, loved being on the farm, but it was tough. And, you know, like I said, I kind of grew up and got to kind of a lot of my childhood, you know, those, even teenage years was the 80s going into the 90s. there was a lot of family farms lost in that stretch, and they didn't necessarily lose it right then, but I saw a lot of farms lost. Theirs eventually did dissolve in the late 90s, and I would say it like this, just never really fully recovered Concord debt from that stretch of time, you know. And so I grew up on the farm, working on the farm, learning things that I wanted to do. Knew then I wanted to raise cattle. That was kind of the dream. Had no idea, honestly, how to do it, how to start it. And eventually, I'm afraid to say the exact year, but eventually a foreclosed notice was served on the family farm, mm-hmm. and it was sold. Kind of the long story of it was, I had already bought my first farm before they were foreclosed upon. And I remember lining the machinery up in the front yard and everything, helping organize all that for mom and dad to sell. And it was tough. I mean, that's where I grew up. That's where my roots were. Just devastatingly tough.
But did that fortify for you as an adult now and as you were starting your family? Yes. Did that fortify for you, reinforce to you of the lifestyle that you wanted to have? Not necessarily mm-hmm. how many cows you were going to raise right. or what you were going to do, right. but growing up in that environment, did that set the mark for how you wanted to raise your family?
I learned very quickly then, a lot of times like this, debt's sort of a necessary evil, a lot of business, a lot of farms. I knew if I was going to be a farmer and begin, I'd have to do it with debt. But I knew I had to manage it. I knew I couldn't let it get out of control. I knew I could not do things that did not earn and pay me back, you know. And I knew I wanted to grow up or work, you know, raise a family on a farm, be on a farm. To me, I knew I was going to start humbling. I was going to start slow if I could ever even get started. But probably what I didn't expect was as things work and things clicked a little bit, how fast it could grow. You know, there was a spell even before I was married, you know, myself doing my own farm business was actually growing quicker than I could finance it. And I turned down things at stretches there, you know, early in my life that I would have liked to have latched onto. Probably thought I could handle the work. I could manage it. I could hire some help and continue to grow, but I was scared of the debt. I did not want to kind of go into debt too much too fast. I knew I needed to learn to repay and meet those repayment schedule, because I didn't want that stress on my family. I didn't want it on me personally. And, a little later in life, you know, being married before we had kids, I just knew, you know, farm credit, I'm going to plug farm credit for a minute for years. Before I was even a customer, or becoming a customer, I should say, one of the first, mission statements I saw on some of their, paraphernalia was they want to be a provider of constructive credit, which in my mind's like, let's not get in too deep. You know, you need to have a good sort of an asset base to get started with them. But I always thought that's the way a man should look at debt as or borrowing money, is to do constructive things with it, which I think we probably all think we are and are going to when we're thinking about buying something else or expanding. But I really took that to heart because that's kind of how my brain worked. I knew I had to keep my debt managed to what I could handle, and I had no I didn't have too much pride to act like I couldn't do something, or maybe I should just slow it down a little bit. And early on in life, I did quite a bit of that. Just I've often wondered, you know, over the years, should I have latched onto something else and tried it or not?
Coulda, shoulda, woulda. You'll just never know the rest.
But I don't second guess, because life's been good. It's just grown and grown and been good to us, and blessed with a healthy family and a good wife. So I don't know how I got here, so to speak, but I'm just trying to make good decisions my whole life and just take it as it came.
I'm going to give you one more question and we'll wrap up from here. What's it mean to you to be named by Kentucky Farm Bureau as Farmer of the Year? I mean, I don't see you as a man with an ego. Mm-hmm. I see a very humble, hardworking guy that appreciates the wife and the kids and the family. Well, but they've said that above them all, mm-hmm. you're the Farmer of the Year. That's gotta feel good.
I really appreciate saying that, Jeff. And it's, you know, Matt Hilton asked me that question during the interview here at the house, and I'm gonna be honest, I stumbled with it. It was because I am a little bit taken back by it. I'm very humbled by it. I'll say it again. I grew up very humbly, good family, good place in the world to be, you know, and was taught right from wrong and how to act and how to treat people with my parents. And it was hard to see it lost, if you want to know the truth. And I've just tried to be so careful, but yet look for opportunity, just pursue it and just make good decisions. And for no other reason over the 30, 35 years now of doing this, it was never because there was a Farmer of the Year or there was anything like that. It's just, I knew I wanted to do the best I could and getting married and starting that family later on. I wanted to do a good job for all of us, you know, because maybe it says Farmer of the Year, but it's a family. It's a family business. It's a family operation. And I'm so glad to have my family, but I've always been fascinated with the farm and the business side of it too. I like the cattle business. I'm a commercial cattle guy through and through, from that cow calf, that stock, or those finished cattle, you know, and I've learned so many things over the years, and I'm glad I can share with my sons now. And I get a lot of calls from, you know, young guys around the community that's got questions, and sometimes I feel like I helped them when they call, and sometimes I don't know if I quite got the answer for them they were looking for, but I appreciate being able to share and give that back, because to be honest, a lot of guys did that for me. They were good to me, and they taught me, and they probably worried about me a little bit at times getting started with a young family and taking on so much, but God's been good to me. I really do appreciate it all.
So when you had that ring in your pocket, mm-hmm. and you were getting ready to ask her, did she know that it was a package deal, Scott and cows?
I'm actually glad my wife's not sitting here right now. We were married in 1999, July the 2nd, and of all things to be a cattle guy and wanting to get the farm going, so to speak. It's also the first year I made some big decisions that I was going full on cows. I stopped baling hay. I was going to buy them hay. The spring of 99, we were building fence and busting fence posts. It was so dry trying to build them. And by July the 2nd, Jeff, it was really dry. And I was getting pretty depressed. And I remember we got married, and of course I was still growing tobacco then too. And Marianne, a very patient woman, I told her, I said, we can't take a honeymoon when we get married. I said, I've got to get the tobacco crop growed, and I've got to get the calves weaned in the fall. I said, so when it slows down a hair, but maybe we even want to strip the tobacco and get it sold, so it may be late in the year. And she actually taught school then. She was a public school teacher. And she said, well, she would kind of engineer her break to do it when we was able. So she was really patient with me. But it turned into the driest, most miserable summer ever was. I sold about half my cows just to survive it because I couldn't feed them, you know. It wasn't that I couldn't bought hay, but I couldn't find it. It just wasn't anywhere around. And so it was a bit of a setback, kind of a year to get started. And she'd still tell you this. I laugh about it. Like she said, oh, if I knew what I was walking into, I might have thought twice. But hey, we survived it. It rained. We got rolled the next year. We never looked back. So.
Did you ever take her on a honeymoon?
I tell you, that fall we did take off ago, we flew to Denver, Colorado, and kind of toured through the Rocky Mountains. And about the first time I ever got on an airplane, but I did some things there that I'd never done. But we made it. We went to Denver and rented a car and just took time and did what we wanted for a few days. So
excellent.
I owe her a trip back, to be honest. I always promised I'd take her back again, but I haven't delivered on that one.